the retreats would be comprised of mindfulness practice together, and then engaging with a theme. And the theme we chose last year was the housing and homelessness crisis. So we'd engage with that.
Welcome to the Social Fabric podcast. I'm your host, Andrea Splendori, and this week my guest is Neve Barrett. Neve is a meditation and mindfulness facilitator, and she runs a practice called Showing Up that offers a framework for engaging with some of the most difficult issues facing our society today and supported by mindfulness practice. There are over 90 episodes in the archive, so please subscribe, share, and review if you get a chance. It's the only way podcasts like this get a chance to survive. The program is also broadcast weekly on Near FM 90.3 every Monday afternoon at 4:30. The songs in the podcast are shortened for rights reason. You can find the full playlist on Spotify on the Social Fabric. The title tune is Alice by Lucky Bones.
Can I call you up, oh Alice, on a Friday night? We could reminisce on old days and we could talk a while. Just sit and talk a while.
I'm chatting to Neve Barrett, Showing Up Ireland. And thanks a million, Neve. And we were just saying about the moment, at the moment, this coronavirus, it's putting us all into a strange place. And you were just starting to say how you're finding it, that it's really interesting time to listen. Tell me a bit about that experience in the last, like, 3 weeks at this stage, I suppose.
Yeah, well, my experience, probably like a lot of people's, is that it's just been changing so much. The ground is constantly shifting under my feet, not sure what's happening next, and the way we've been just forced to stop, so much of the world has been forced to stop, it creates a kind of a silence, I think, when so much of the busy noise is taken away. You can hear things. That's what it feels like. I can hear things from my own life, maybe, that I hadn't really had time to pay attention to, or I was just rushing around too much, or didn't want to. But also, what's really loud for me are, all I can describe, the only way I can describe it, is kind of cries for help from beyond my four walls, from people who were under pressure, an intense pressure before this even started, and now who are in very, very difficult situations. And it's kind of impossible not to hear that for me, and I know for other people as well, that, you know, we've just become aware of so much that we knew was wrong and couldn't be sustained, but it's just so much more vivid now. I hear it sometimes described as being amplified. These situations have been amplified by this, because so much of the other noise is taken away.
Yeah. And what's happening around where you are in terms of real life stories, in terms of that cry for help, or even just a little bit toned down to that, like your neighborhood? I know we're all kind of locked in, we can't really do much, but we are allowed to see our neighbors and make sure that everybody's fine. And what's happening around where you are? Is it much going on in terms of looking after each other? Or
yeah, like I live on a little square in Bray, and quite early on we put a call out to people who'd be willing to provide their phone number to anyone who needed to make a phone call for some help or just for a chat, you know. And so we did that a couple of weeks ago, and we got like 20, 25 numbers and put them on a piece of paper and put them into everybody's letterbox, even for the mental comfort of knowing, well, there's always somebody I can ring. There's 20 numbers here. Somebody's going to pick up the phone. Mm. And then, of course, we formed the inevitable WhatsApp group of those people. And now we're getting loads of jokes and and thankfully not many people needing assistance seemingly so far.
As you say, it's the comfort of knowing that there is the community there. But that's interesting you say about the WhatsApp, because it's that love-hate relationship with WhatsApp, because it's nice to be in a group to keep up with things. But then, as you say, there's the jokes and there's
the videos, and at the moment they're quite funny. But at the same time, I was thinking of that yesterday. I had to go outside of the 2 kilometer radius for the first time. I had to go and get some essentials, and I was like, wow, I really miss conversations. Like, I know I'm doing a lot of this, which is great, but my day is full of conversations, impromptu conversation. Now I don't have that. And it, WhatsApp is kind of good for that, to keep people in touch. But it's interesting that people, there hasn't been enough need for help. Or do you think, are people not contacting you, contacting the 20 numbers because they feel, I don't want to bother them? Or what's your sense of that?
I think so far, I mean, what are we now? This is day 12 of our lockdown today, of our 2 kilometer radius lockdown. Mm. And there has been a sense that it's not, the numbers aren't getting as high as were originally feared. But also you're seeing that reporting dampened down because it's coming up to Easter weekend, and you know, we don't want to create a false sense of security and complacency and for it to come up again. So what I'm thinking is that actually people are doing okay. They have their existing support networks already. Like, it's a very caring community that I'm fortunate enough to be living in. And us collecting these 20 names was just a safety net under the safety nets, if you like, you know. So I think people are doing okay, but you know, we just don't know, do we?
No, we don't. We don't.
What the news is going to say tomorrow?
I know it probably could be longer than we expect it to be. But look, hopefully we all be safe, and I think it's the right thing to do to follow the instructions. Somebody out there seem to know more than we do, you know. So
yeah, and you know, I think one thing that's been brought home, certainly to me, if I sensed it before, I know it now, is how interconnected we are and how dependent upon one another, and how even staying home has an impact on other people ultimately. Mm. It's really brought that into focus, and that's a very positive thing.
Sure. Okay, well, let's tell you what, the song you gave me is Thin Love With You, Thin Lizzy. That's the first song. And tell me again about it.
Yeah, it's funny. These songs feel like from an earlier civilization now. Pre-COVID, PC. Yeah, Thin Lizzy, Still In Love With You. My first gig was Thin Lizzy's farewell gig in 1983. And I was just a baby. But it was such a wonderful experience to hear live music for the first time, and to hear it, you know, in the form of Thin Lizzy, obviously. And Phil Lynott was, it might sound strange, but I think he was a really beautiful man and very charismatic and interesting. And yeah, it was such a loss, like all those years ago.
Wow, that's it. That's some great gig to be the first gig. And you were a baby, and who did you go with?
Of course. So we were kids. I was 13. But we were lucky enough to, we were hanging around with one of the children of Thin Lizzy's personnel. And very generously, we were all invited along, a gang of kids, to that gig. And then we were brought backstage afterwards and we met Phil, and it was absolutely fantastic. But yeah, it had a huge impression on me, obviously.
Fake, I'll just fall to pieces if I don't find something else to do. This sadness never ceases.
Okay, I'm going to ask you, I'm going to start from the end this time, because what do you do at the moment? You do your showing up mindfulness. there's a lot to do with what's going on. It must have changed a lot in the last few weeks. And yes, it's a very important thing that you're doing for the community. So give us an idea of showing up and your project and all of that.
Yeah, well, I'm a mindfulness facilitator, and I practice mindfulness meditation, and I have done for some years now. And the tradition that I've been practicing in most recently is the Zen tradition. This particular organization is very involved with social engagement, and in bringing mindfulness and meditation awareness into the socially engaged sphere. So I've had some retreat experiences with them that were just so powerful, and that just seemed to bridge different aspects of my life, which was to say my personal practice on the cushion, as it were, and then what I was seeing in the world and how I wanted to engage with what I was seeing in the world that was actually troubling me and that I wanted to change. You know, in meditation instruction, we're invited just to let things be as they are, you know, to allow our frustration, to allow our disappointment, to allow whatever is happening, and to let it come go. And in my experience anyway, as I practiced this over the years, what I began to notice was that I was noticing more. Generally, I was noticing more in my life, but I was also beginning to notice more in the world, where I would have been quite self-absorbed, quite cut off, just doing my own thing, ticking my boxes, getting through my life. And over the years of practice, that started to soften and expand a bit. And I'd be just a little more available, I suppose, to be touched by what I saw around me. And so when I came across the Zen Peacemaker organization, who were very much emphasizing social engagement as a type of practice, you know, it just seemed to join the dots for me. So I began to offer some retreats in that tradition, and the retreats would be comprised of mindfulness practice together. And then engaging with a theme, and the theme we chose last year was the housing and homelessness crisis. So we'd engage with that by volunteering and learning from people who were on the front lines of that situation, and contributing some money, and then coming back to our base to gather together in what's called a connection circle, which is like a talking circle, but it's a mindful talking circle. So that we could hear from each other and also from ourselves how what we had witnessed was landing for us. So one of the tenets of the Zen Peacemakers is bearing witness. So not knowing is the first one, which is coming into a situation with an open and curious mind, as we're sort of taught in our mindfulness practice, to come in with an open, curious mind. And then from there, we bear witness, we see things as they are, and we allow ourselves to be available for that. And then the third tenet of the Zen Peacemakers is taking action. So action naturally arises from bearing witness. And that might sound, I hope that doesn't sound too abstract. It's definitely worth exploring if anybody wants to, zenpeacemakers.org. But these are very helpful tenets for me in coming close to situations that are really difficult and challenging, but when we have a framework and we have a practice underneath us of awareness and compassion too, it's really possible to engage. And my experience was that I had way more capacity than I realized. I had more ability to be present and to respond than I realized before. I don't think that we're educated into realizing our impact, which of course during this time we are being educated into in lots of ways, but also our capacity. So it's a two-way thing. Like, we need to nurture ourselves so that we can show up in the world, and then showing up in the world nurtures us. So it goes around.
I'm going to ask you a little bit more about the showing up, but it's interesting what you just said at the beginning of this, the silence and listening to the silence. And and then the mindfulness now that you've been practicing, that it really and the impact. So all that is coming together now. We're all realizing how much more each of us have, how much I have an impact on your life and you on mine through, well, obviously at the moment it's this crazy pandemic thing is going on, but effectively once this is over, we should be able to still practice that, right? Is that what you're saying? Just listen now that you have the time to listen. And when this is over, try to avoid the noise.
Yeah, absolutely. And listen to as best I can. I try and listen without expectation to what each day is teaching me, because honestly, each day has something different. Mm. It's amazing. And nature, like just being able to go outside and watch spring is incredible. It's there's all this learning, you know. So for me, there's a sense of this window will close eventually. And I have to say, thankfully for a lot of people, because it's very difficult for lots of people. But because I have this luxury of a bit of headspace right now, what do I want to preserve from this time to bring forward? Like, mm-hmm. What wheel do I want to put my shoulder to when this is over that I'm witnessing now? If that makes sense.
No, absolutely. It's a nice picture of the window and the wheel. No, absolutely. Great. Now, you picked Kate Bush. Wow. Why?
Yeah. She was so much a part of my childhood and my life since, to be honest. I think the first time I saw Kate Bush was on Top of the Pops, and I was 7 or 8 years old, and she was doing Wuthering Heights, and I remember just thinking she was kind of scary, very spooky, but fascinating. And that fascination with her has never really dimmed. She's such an amazing artist and woman. And this song, Wow, is very atmospheric for me.
When I first came across you, and I think it was through social media, I can't remember exactly which one or whatever. Anyway, I came across the name, and I just thought the name showing up was interesting for a starter. And then I delved a little bit into it, and you just gave us a feel for it. But what I really liked, what really interested me was that a lot of mindfulness and meditation that I hear about is about being in touch with yourself and blah, 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 and you know, getting closer to your inner self, et cetera, which is all good. But for me, there was too much me with the mindfulness and meditation. While with what you do, and if you can elaborate a little bit more about, for example, the homelessness, the way you actually did that, I thought that was, it's a great way of using your own personal strength and mindfulness as part of a group to help other people and to engage. So explain to me a little bit that particular case when you went over into Stephen's Green and the homelessness, and because that's, I think, is really interesting.
Yeah. So on one evening we had a kind of a short retreat evening, and we met together to practice, because we always begin with that. That's the ground that we're coming from, is our mindfulness meditation practice, that awareness that allows us to be in touch and present. And then we walked down to the College Green, where every Monday evening a group called A Lending Hand are there, just showing up every Monday evening and still showing up during this crisis to give people food and sometimes clothes or sleeping bags or whatever people need. And they're just there. They put out tables, they bring cooked food from where they live. Lots of them come from Coolock. they're baking all day in their houses and their mother's houses, and they're bringing things into town then for people to eat on a Monday evening. And as part of our kind of practices, raising money and offering donations, I had asked Kira, who runs it, what they needed. So they told me they needed sleeping bags on that evening. I think it was sleeping bags that evening. So we had a whole bunch of those, and we brought those down, and we gathered together first to remind ourselves of our tenets of not knowing and bearing witness and taking action, and also taking care of ourselves, not leaving ourselves out of the picture. And then we just went around, and we were there and offered the sleeping bags that we had, and just had chats, to be honest. And it was, in one way, it was all very kind of normal and not a big deal. And it was kind of human to human. It wasn't like we're not coming in as though we're on high and we're helping from this high position and aren't people lucky. It's more like, how can I be available to you in this moment? And I happen to have this sleeping bag that you might need, but really I'm just here as a person to listen again to this situation and to be available and present as best that I can. So that was the spirit of it. And then we would usually mindfully, after we'd finished there, we were there about an hour and a half, and then we'd have a mindful walk back up to our base. So we'd walk up through Grafton Street and Stephen's Green, and we'd walk in silence and just bear witness to what was present for us and what's around us as we're walking through town. And we'd come back to our base, and then we have this wonderful practice that I've been actually doing a lot through this crisis online, which is, it's called Council Circle. I call it Connection Circle. And it's a really important core practice in showing up, because it's where we really come together and have a chance to speak from the heart, as the guidelines for it go, speak from the heart and listen from the heart to what our experience is and whatever it is that we've noticed. And that's how we end all our engagements, is in circle together.
Yeah, and I really like that. I like the idea, because you put in a practice that a lot of us, including myself, can see a bit too hairy-fairy, and you know, you're talking about it. There's a lot of it at the moment. There's a lot of meditation, and I think it's all very good. But at the same time, I think the fact that you put into practice with something very tangible and very important, like a homeless crisis, and the people from Kuluk you mentioned, and that they do it every week. They're superheroes. Nobody knows who they are, but they're just there every week. They've been doing it for years and years, you know. And what was their reaction to the people? They show up there, not your group, but the guys that are there, Kira, yeah, and all the other girls there, or the
Kira
guys.
Kira and Ashley. Well, I had reached out to a couple of groups, and I think like that, maybe like a bit like you're saying, they think, oh, meditation, what's this about? Yeah. You know? Yeah. No, thanks, you know. But Kira, she's just so open. She said, yeah, sure, come on down to me on a Monday and we'll chat, and you can tell me what it's about and you can see what the setup is. And so that's what I did. I went along one Monday evening and I met her and I helped out a little bit and described to her what we were doing, and she seemed fine with it. And she just wants to provide support to people, and we were also offering some support, but she was really open to us, and yeah, I'm very grateful to her. She trusted us.
Oh, that's great.
And it's been a wonderful partnership. Like we've been with her a couple of times. And like I say, it's very hard to sum it up, but it really is, for each person who takes part in it, it's a personal thing of a conversation or witnessing something, or just, it's the direct experience is so important, I think, of something that we hear about all the time. It's constantly kind of mediated by the political world or the media, which do a very good job, but it can be at a remove. We need to to be there, I think.
I agree.
In the place. And to realize, yeah, I can do this. I can respond. And it's not overwhelming when we do it like that. And especially when we do it together. Yeah. That's what makes it possible. It has to be together, I think.
Absolutely. Okay. Alphabet Street, Prince.
So hard to pick a Prince song. You could have, you know, seven Prince songs, couldn't you? But this one is from kind of probably a lesser regarded Prince album called Love Sexy, which came right after Sign of the Times. And I was very lucky to be brought to this gig in Wembley by a nice boyfriend I had at the time. He took me to see Prince on this tour. And yeah, I think this is the album that I just played to death the most. So that's where Alphabet Street comes from. And it's Prince at his kind of cheeky, sexual bravado best as well.
I'm going down to Alphabet Street. I'm gonna crown this girl that I meet. I'm gonna talk so sexy. She want me from my head to my feet.
The other day, I had a conversation with Liam Mwenden of the frontman of the Hot Ass Flowers for this podcast, and he had a great saying. He says, you know, we give each other value by just having a conversation, just having a chat, you know, and effectively that's what you're saying with your mindfulness group. Those conversations on College Green enriched each one of you in a way completely different, your enrichment. So the group you have, and I know you do a month, I think it's every Monday, you pre-corona, you did it every Monday in Bray, and you have a steady group of people coming to your practice?
Yeah, I think we were just going like 4 or 5 weeks before corona arrived. Mm. And again, it was just space to practice and to be in circle together and to explore themes.
Hmm.
So that group was very much forming. And then along came Corona, and then that moved online. So
is that still going online?
Yeah, every Monday evening it's happening online. Showingup.ie has a page of what's happening during this time. Because I'm offering circle just for people to express what's alive for them, really, a space for that and for some mindfulness practice. And then I encourage people to make a donation to one of those frontline services like a Lending Hand, say, or Inner City Helping Homeless, or somebody who's out there, Women's Aid, obviously, as well, are doing a lot more work at the moment, too, sadly. So trying to keep the social engagement in the picture, but really my focus now is just giving people the space to drop into that listening quality to this time. I'm coming up with, I don't want to call it a course, because a course feels like a bit of a burden at the moment. I don't want to do a course now, but like a loose framework for inquiry, shall we say, around our experience of this time and what it might be evoking in us as regards what are the situations that we need to attend to when this is over? What kind of a society do we want to build when this is over, and what's important to us? And so I will be offering something in the next couple of weeks, which is a bit more focused around the social engagement piece, but is in a very gentle way that, as I say, it's individual to everyone. It has to come out of our own life, what we're drawn to, I believe. And that's where we get the ability to stay in for the long haul, because it's meaningful to us, you know. So it's a bit of an exploration of that territory I'll be doing quite soon.
But I guess that's you as the facilitator of mindfulness, and I'm guessing you obviously you'd be more aware of what's happening around you. You learning all the time from your circles, from what people need and what, where they're at with their heads and what needs to be offered next. Is that, am I right in saying that part of what
you... I mean, I'm hearing, it's just as the teacher, Bernie Glassman, who founded the Zen Peacemaker Order, he talks a lot about both the joy and suffering of life. And this situation is very much both sides of the coin. And so I'm seeing that people are having a very difficult time, and some other people are very grateful for all the space that they have now without so much struggle maybe for them. But from that, can we look beyond our own life and see what needs to happen? So I'm hearing a wide range of experience. Yes, I'm hearing a lot of anxiety and uncertainty and grief and regret. And also a sense of hope, a real sense of hope and relief that finally the brakes were slammed on, because there's a sense that we may have just been just going headlong towards the edge of a cliff, knowing that we were, like, in full awareness of it and unable to stop it. So not to overstate this moment, but it's presenting a lot. You know, So it's how we engage with that individually, I think, is the important thing.
And out of curiosity, is your groups predominantly women, or is it mixed, or is it irrelevant?
You know, I would say more women, but it's certainly not exclusively women. It could be a third men to two thirds women. It's great when there's men and women. It just, I don't know, it does something. It just rounds everything out in a way I can't quite describe, but it's lovely. It really amplifies the sense of community for me anyway.
The reason I'm asking, obviously, being a man, I'm just trying to put myself in somebody else's shoe, and this situation we're in, it just caused so much distress for everybody, because even from the smallest thing, now we're all in the same house, you know, me and my family, we're all in the same house, and we all need to get used to giving each other the space that before was afforded to everybody else, because one is out of working, or the two are out working, and one is in school. You know, there's physical space that is available in the house for, call it mindfulness, call it time out, and now there isn't. So now it's, you know, took a couple of weeks to get adjusted to it and say, okay. But I suppose, like, if for a lot of us men, we would do our Zoom virtual pub, you know, which is just another way of getting in touch with your friends, you know, which is fine. There's absolutely nothing wrong with it. But I was just curious if people would actually say, okay, well, now I'm going to go spend an hour online and do mindfulness, you know.
Well, I think I'm getting the sense that people are more open to it at the moment. I'm part of a collective of mindfulness facilitators who we're offering sessions every day free on Zoom, and there's four slots a day, and there's about 20 of us doing it. And I mean, some of the people we know that come for sure, but some of them are new to it, and lots of them actually are men that we're seeing. So I think there might be an openness to trying it, and also a big part of the Zoom experience is being with other people. Yeah. And it's quite tangible. I don't know if you feel that when you meet your friends, but it's not the same. It's not the real thing, but it's not bad.
No, we're adjusting to it. We're adjusting to this. We are adjusting, definitely. The physical contact is the problem, really. The slap on the shoulder, the hug, that's the problem.
Yeah, and people on our, like, in my circle online or in the meditation sessions, some of them have been inside for 2 weeks and they haven't seen anybody. So not even having a hug, but not even seeing anyone in the flesh. And then they, you know, the online experience is great for them. They say that's hard.
Mm-hmm.
But somebody said to me today, I don't know if this will resonate for you, Andrea. She said, if you can, just hug a tree.
I'm again, not there yet.
No, not quite. It's not the same, but it's not bad.
I might do that. I might try. You never know. I might enjoy it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Tree huggers by the end of this.
Tree huggers, yeah.
I'm
going to go and buy some sandals this afternoon. tell me about Joni Mitchell, Refuge of the Roads.
Yeah. Another amazing woman and artist. So Prince actually sent me in the direction of Joni Mitchell. In one of his songs on Sign of the Times, he quotes from a song called Help Me, I Think I'm Falling, in brackets. So of course, because I loved Prince so much, any recommendation from him, I was going to follow. So that's where I began with a long, long career of really, really loving Joni Mitchell. And I love this song. This is a more modern arrangement of the song, and it's her voice is, you can hear all the years of her life in her voice. It's really beautiful.
I met a friend of spirit. He drank and womanized, and I sat before his sanity. I was holding back from crying. He saw my complications, and he mirrored me back simplified, and we laughed how our perfection would always be denied.
You were one of the early adapter of mindfulness. When I say one of the early, you know, it has become a big, big thing the last couple of years. But from talking to you before, you got into this quite a while ago, and I'm just like to know a little bit more about why and how and where were you at that stage, when what were you doing and why did you get into it, and how, as you say, it changed you personally, and just give me a bit of an idea of all of that.
Yeah, so during the peak of the Celtic Tiger, I realized I needed to move out of Dublin, and I moved to Kilkenny, where I had a couple of friends and a place I knew pretty well, and I ended up living there for 7 years, which is such a beautiful place. But as part of that move, I realized also that I needed to, or wanted to learn meditation. And luckily enough, there was a little Buddhist center there out in the countryside outside Kilkenny, just outside Callan, just down a little Boreen, this meditation center run by two people there, Gar Freeney, God rest him. He died in 2014, and Bear Cody. And that's where I learned to meditate in 2005. And it was, I think it was a couple of things that brought me into it. It was a sense of needing to understand my emotions better. I would have experienced a fair bit of anxiety and also depression at some stages during my life. So it was wanting to try and understand all of that and work with it. But also I was quite a spiritual child, or religious. Not so much religious, I suppose, but I was, yeah, I loved being in the church, and I loved the gospel, and, you know, I probably still consider myself a Christian in some respects, but I definitely fell out of connection with Catholicism, like many people did. I didn't feel it had a place for me as a woman. I didn't feel any connection with it anymore. But that part of me was still looking for some way of coming to that stillness that I would feel in the church when I was a child. And meditation gave me that too. So it was kind of a push-pull. I was being pushed by anxiety to find some tools. and then pulled back into this kind of way of being that I had left behind in childhood, but I wanted to connect with again.
But in 2005, when you started, we weren't talking about meditation and mindfulness as we do now. So you were a tree hugger then. You were seen as the as the weird one that goes down the road.
A hippie.
Well, no, but jokes aside, that was, you know, not everybody in you know, when you went out to meet your friends in Kilkenny, not everybody was doing it, right?
Well, it definitely wasn't been talked about the way it was now. And actually, mindfulness is rarely referred to as meditation now, but that's what it is at root. It is meditation. I started training in 2007, and there were a few people already teaching it in Ireland. But a gang of us would go over to the University of Bangor in North Wales on the boat from Dunleary and have the crack on the way, and then have our day of training, which was a real wham bam day of training, and then on the boat back, oh, what the hell was that? And try and figure it out. So that was 2007. So it was, yeah, it was starting to become less kind of weird or kind of a fringe thing. And you see, loads of research has been done into the 8-week program that I would facilitate and subsequent programs as well. There's been a huge body of research, and that really has put it into the mainstream that, you know, it's been shown to help with different conditions like anxiety in my case, and just a general feeling of kind of health and well-being, an ability to cope, an ability to appreciate life a bit more, and those would be the small things in life, not the big things, but the little things that actually the day is kind of made up of. And like you say, the conversation on the street, those little things that you miss when they're gone, mindfulness really helps you to appreciate those. So anyway, this you know, there's a range of things that have been researched about it. So that helped that there was some kind of evidence base for it, especially for mindfulness-based cognitive therapy for depression. In the UK, that was recommended as an alternative to antidepressant medication. So that's where it was placed in the conversation. And that's when it really began to spread. So it was moving outside of, you know, connotations of meditation and hippies sitting around and going off and hugging trees then. And, you know, it just moved, and it became much more accessible then to more people.
Mm, interesting. Okay. Stevie Wonder, Living for the City.
Yeah. So Stevie Wonder is, he's just a tonic. If I'm ever a bit down, like I put on Stevie Wonder and it's gone. Like he's just so full of joy. But in this song particularly, he's also full of a kind of what is called in Buddhism, fierce compassion. Like you can hear it in his voice. He's telling this story about how these people are trying to live and how difficult it is for them. But there is so much respect in his voice. And it's so full of, just so full of power. So I just find it inspiring in terms of being engaged in the world. It's a wonderful song about it.
A boy's born in hard time Mississippi, surrounded by for world that ain't so pretty. His parents give him love and affection to keep him strong. Moving in the right direction, living just enough for the city. His father works some days for 14 hours.
You mentioned anxiety and depression there. I read somewhere, some people say it's the same thing, looking at it from two different angles. But anyway, regardless of that, I'm not too sure. But regardless of that, so you went through it, and I don't know if cure yourself is the right word, but by doing what you do, by your mindful practicing daily, has it helped your anxiety, your depression?
Yeah. Thankfully, the depression hasn't really come back since I was pretty young. I mean, but the anxiety does come and go. It does help. And it helps by allowing me to be in a different relationship to it. So what we'll say in a mindfulness course when somebody's coming onto the course and we're talking to them beforehand is, it's not going to get rid of the thing, whatever the thing is. It's not going to make it go away, most likely. But what it does is it gives you the space and freedom to be in a different relationship to it. You have a different awareness of it when it's there and a way of meeting it. Mm. So I still experience anxiety from time to time. It comes and it goes, and it may always come and go, but it's not so much of a problem. Like at times I will still find myself quite caught in it and kind of acting out of it, you know, but eventually the light bulb goes on and I realize, oh yeah, this is what's happening. And there's compassion in mindful awareness as well. It's not just attention. It's a particular flavor of attention that's kind of, it's kind of allowing. We might not like the experience, but I can just allow it to be. And then something happens. It there's just a bit of space around it. It's still there, but it feels different for it to be there. And it's workable. And I can just get on with my day, you know? So that's how it helps with that experience of anxiety. And then, as I said, it has the other function as well of just focusing or refining my attention so that I can catch things that are fleeting but really beautiful that I might miss when I'm just in my thoughts all the time.
Okay.
So I think those are the ways it helps.
What I was going to go with this question was, you're a mother, I'm a father, you know, children and anxiety seem to be a thing now. There seem to be a lot of anxiety with children and teenagers and so on. And I know some schools have introduced, I don't know, during TY they do some mindfulness practice, and some of the schools are starting to do a bit more. But my question really is it an opportunity for us, and not, I don't mean the school, but for us as a society to introduce that new, and as I know, mindfulness is not it's something you do, it's not something, it's something you are as opposed to something you do. You just to introduce something for our society to counteract the anxiety that we're creating for ourselves. Like as we just said at the beginning of this conversation, now that it's all quiet, all of a sudden we don't really have to worry too much about too many things. So aside from social media and Netflix, maybe everything else, it's okay. It's toned down. So should we do something as a society? Should we learn more the Eastern culture, the Zen, to prevent our children to be anxious?
Yeah, I think it can be really helpful for children, and it can be really helpful for everyone. But I guess I see another aspect to it, which is I think as a society we need to become more trauma aware. And by that, I mean, like, we can say to people, oh, you should try mindfulness. And yeah, it's a wonderful thing to try. But if you've experienced a lot of trauma in your life, it's actually not that easy to come into mindfulness practice. It can be really difficult, and we can end up blaming ourselves that we can't do it or so on. But actually, there's something else that needs attention first. And that can be some trauma that we've experienced as children or as adults, but that's there and needs attention. So what's happening in the mindfulness world now more and more is that there's more awareness of trauma and trauma sensitivity, and giving people lots of choices when they come into mindfulness practice around where they place their attention. For example, we place a lot of focus on the body in mindfulness practice, which is a wonderful thing because we become so divorced from our body. But if somebody has experienced a lot of trauma, that's not going to be easy for them at all. So we're educating ourselves all the time about how mindfulness can help. But in terms of how we come back out into the world, I really feel that we need to look at how trauma is generated in people's lives. And a lot of it is kind of what we would call structural It's how society is organized. It sets people up for experiencing trauma, having to live in poverty, living with addiction. You know, there's been studies into how all these affect children, and they're called adverse childhood experiences. And we don't have to go into it now, but basically, people can be set up because of the way our society is organized to become traumatized. And it's very difficult for them to flourish in their life. And then we tend to judge them. And we say things like, well, they're not getting out of bed early in the morning, stuff like that. It really is not their fault. Trauma is a nervous system response. It's not a choice. So I think mindfulness in conjunction with trauma awareness and the changes that need to happen in our society to allow people to have a chance to flourish in their life, they all go together. And they go really well together. So I think mindfulness practice is always wonderful to offer, and it does help us to become more emotionally intelligent and have more choice. But it's recognizing that there's other things at play as well.
Mm. And specifically for young adults and teenagers, I'm very keen on that generation, because they're the ones that are going to look after us, and the ones that are going to change this world. How easy is to get teenagers into, like, it's one thing to do an hour or a week in school, but have you had experience, you know, as any of your the clients come to you, bring along their teenagers, or have they, and what, how easy is it for a teenager to get into it?
There are groups of teenagers that will meet and practice together, and I think that's probably the key to it. I don't know if any teenager is going to listen to their parent who says, okay, now we're going to sit down together and we're going to meditate.
No, yeah, and that's the point.
Maybe. Now, I'm not the parent of a teenager yet. My daughter's 11, but I feel with teenagers sometimes the thing they really need is the thing they're just pushing you away about. Sometimes, you know. So it's creating a lot of opportunities for them, and maybe starting it when they're younger with them. Like, I don't sit down and meditate with my daughter. She wouldn't have it for a second, you know. But what I try and do is just cultivate curiosity and, you know, emotional intelligence, you could say, but just to allow her to experience her emotions and to feel them and to not judge them, because that's in with a group of adults in a mindfulness course, so much of our work is uncovering all the emotions that we thought we weren't allowed to have but are having. And maybe running our life. So if we can start younger with that, that's great. But there's no way my kid is sitting down with me. She just laughs. Yeah, I think teenagers, they do best with their peers, right? So, yeah. And then they may just flat out say no. And what can you do?
That's fair enough. Yeah, no, I thought you had the magic potion, but if you don't, it's okay.
No, I certainly don't.
Okay, the second last song is Fist of Fury. Kamasi Washington?
Yeah, Kamasi Washington.
Kamasi Washington.
So Kamasi Washington is one of the great musical discoveries for me of the last couple of years. He's a jazz saxophone player, but he's a band leader, so he's a composer. And he has this Stevie Wonder, like what we were saying, he has this spark of kind of fierce compassion, especially in this song, where this song is just saying, no, enough, you know, enough of this. But his music is really beautiful as well. And really, this is quite a big, almost angry song, but he's got some wonderfully quiet music as well. And he's just amazing. But it's his heart that I hear in it, really. And his band, not just him, of course, his whole band.
Talked about your past, and it's too late now to start
because we're nearly at the end of the conversation.
Oh, God. Great.
And but I'm more interested because I know about it, and that's it. That's enough. The listeners don't need to know. But what I'm more interested, because of the time we're talking and because of what you do, you're obviously taking a lot more time to think about the future, I'm assuming, you know, whether from a personal, from a professional, from, and I'd just like to know how you see the future. What's the plan for you for the next, you know, nobody knows. We could be in these houses for the next 6 weeks, a year, who knows? But what's the plan once this is over? What would you like to see? What's your crystal ball view of the future?
I guess now what I'm really looking forward to is when this is over, whenever that is, meeting people who want to move things in a particular way to contribute to a more compassionate society. I feel like stepping in a bit more directly and getting involved in campaigns that there was too much pulling for my attention before, but now it seems clear to me that there's some movements I want to get involved in. Because as we're saying, there is a chance in this situation to bring things forward towards a more compassionate society, right? And that's where I'm going right now.
Anything specific on those campaigns that you want to talk
about?
Yeah,
I mean, the issue that has really stood out for me, and there's lots of them, but the one that's really front and center for me through all this is the whole issue of domestic violence and abuse and what it means, what lockdown means for somebody who was just barely getting by with the abusive partner, leaving the house for stretches of time, right? You know, and I had run a retreat day around bearing witness to this before, so it's quite close to my heart, and you know, from my earlier life as well. That's where it emanates from. So I guess when I think of the person, and this would probably be different for everybody, and there's lots of people to choose from, but for me, it's the woman who is trapped in her house, the women and children who are trapped in the house. And I know sometimes it's a man, I want to acknowledge that, who is being abused. But for me at the moment, it's a woman, and she has nowhere to go, and she has no money. And so where that is calling me to move towards now is to really look at, what does a universal basic income look like? I've just kind of explored it a little bit, but you know, people need breathing space, and they need to be able to move away, and they need some kind of, a woman needs some kind of financial independence. Everybody does. So that's one really important thing. I believe, I don't know, but I believe Spain are moving straight into, it looks like, a system of universal basic income from what they've been doing so far. It's been trialed before, but in small ways. And I really think that it could ease a lot of the suffering that we're experiencing right now, but also it could create some of the space that we're enjoying right now for those of us who are feeling like, God, this is much more human. I'm not in my car all the time. I can work from home. Maybe I don't need to work so much. That's the luxury. I to investigate that. I don't know enough about it, but I want to investigate that. And obviously the other thing that woman needs is housing, right? So those two issues are drawing me now. And I feel like I want to explore that in a more meaningful way at the end of this.
Well, that's great. Because Women's Aid, they do a great job, right? They're a great organization, Women's Aid.
But so do you see, is it something that you could see doing with your showing up program, for example? Could that be something that you can bring to I'm not sure if there's a woman's age group or something you can bring along. And I know it's not the answer to everything. There's the housing, there's the money, and there's everything else that goes with it. But that's one piece of the jigsaw, right?
Yeah, and like I did a little bit of work with Women's Aid before on one of our retreat days. They came and talked to us and about their work, and then we where we went to, because we always go somewhere to the relevant place as best we can. We went up to Kipur and we had a little ceremony there, and we read out the names that Women's Aid published of all the women who had been killed or were feared dead or feared murdered, I should say, since the 90s. So I've already been involved with them, but what this crisis, I guess, has shown is the possibilities for online gathering. Now, we're on Zoom now, and in the last week, stuff has come out about Zoom maybe not being as watertight as they said they were, and there are issues. But if some of these problems can be ironed out, and again, I'm just talking off the top of my head, I don't know. Somebody could be listening to this and going, no, that won't work. But there could be a way for women to hear each other online, to be anonymous, not seen, but to hear each other online. There's something very powerful right now about hearing each other and how we're getting on. That's resilience building. So, look, I don't know. But I guess I'll keep thinking about it.
Well, that's great. I mean, the acorn is there. It's fantastic. I mean, it'd be fantastic if you could come up with something that would help the cause, because it is a really hard one to understand, to comprehend. And obviously, there's the women's involved, there's the partners involved, there's this society and how we deal with it. You know, if you know something, you know, it's a very complex, but it's a really harsh reality in our community. And it'd be fantastic if you came up with something to help out. I'm sure you will, whatever that is, you know, and just add to the betterment of the community. Really, that's what you've been doing with your practice anyway. That's fantastic. So, as you know, I always ask for my couple of words of wisdom at the end of it. So what are your couple of words of wisdom?
I guess it just comes down to me, or for me rather, to trusting your impact. Trust that you have an impact, and that when you listen to what it is in yourself that is touched, that you can trust that and you can follow that, and that you do have an impact to make things better.
Absolutely. And I think the last song you gave me is a perfect way to let it to finish it, because it's Everything Changes by Peggy Seeger. And that's exactly what has happened since the last time I spoke to you. Everything Changes.
Yeah. Wow, I know.
Yeah. Why Peggy Seeger?
She, again, I saw her live not that long ago, only a few months ago. And she is kind of another living legend, like Kate Bush and Joni Mitchell. And this song, I know you can only play a little bit of it, but it's just so kind of plainly beautiful and heartfelt. And she's looking back on her life, and she's kind of addressing it to her mother, who's long dead, it sounds like, from the song. And she's imagining that her mother is coming out to call her in from play on a dark night. Her mother's coming out to call her back in again as she's coming towards the end of her life. I hope she's not coming towards the end of her life anytime soon, but it has that feel about it. Yeah, I just think it's really, really beautiful.
Okay. Neve Barrett, thanks a million for your time. Really, really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thanks for inviting me on.
The house I lived in when I was a child had woods. We all ran wild. You could hide, then come home. after a while. The town I lived in when I was young, everybody knew my name, the world was my own. Safe in the dark, playing games, till Mama called me home. But that was then, now it's now, everything changes somehow. The house I lived in, the town I lived in, everything changes, everything. I'm afraid.